friendly with everyone.
And they decided not to talk to him.
Well, he was the boss, you see. He was in charge of all of us.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't really the boss, but he's supposed to be the boss. And he... Public Works Department boss, in charge of the reclamation of the bend over here, reclaiming the bend with the Saston's labour, with the dull labour. Well, of course, anything like that happened, well, he was the boss, you see, and nobody took any notice of it. But Specs Donnelly, the little fellow I was just talking
about... Was it the one who died last week?
No, that's Digger Donnelly.
Yeah.
Specs Donnelly lived over in Graham Street. He got dressed up one bloody day in the best clothes he had and come with a paper under his arm, and they had all the drays, the horses and drays lined up just opposite here where the old fire station was. They used to have to line up there.
So there's nothing there at all. Mm.
And across the road from here.
And they get allocated their jobs. Well, Specs, there's a new buddy foreman there, not what's his name, McKinnon. There's a new foreman there and didn't know Specs. He hadn't seen him. And Specs comes there looking with a pencil and paper, looking very important. And he said, I've come to inspect all the horses to see if they're fit for work, you know, from the RSIP, you know. So he goes right along the bloody line, that one's got to go home, that one's got to go home, that one's got to go home. Off goes all the bloody drays and horses back to Sullivan's stables over in Pickle Street, and they're all returned to the stable, and Sullivan's jumping bloody mad. He can't find. McKinnon comes to me, he said, all the horses and drays are gone, because I don't know what's on, see, what's going on. I said, well, what's bloody, what's, that's nothing to do with me, you order them. He says, the bloody bloke from the RSPCA has been down. Somebody gets on the side of him and they said, Specs Donnelly. I said, oh, Jesus. That's the kind of tricks they used to play. Now, the foreman used to have little houses like Dunny houses. You know, that was their way. They used to go and sit in out the weather. They used to, wasn't allowed to sit with the dollies. Well, what they do, they dig a bloody big hole there in the sand in front of it, about 6 feet deep, you know, and put a piece of paper over the top and sprinkle sand. And when that bloody foreman walked in, down he'd go into this hole, and then they'd shovel the sand in and leave the poor bugger there up to his neck in sand.
Now, listen, was Ted Anderson famous for being lazy, was he?
Oh, extra famous. He wouldn't work in a pit.
And how come he didn't get the sack then?
Well, we had such control of the places. They tried Ted everywhere over the bloody bend, and they said, we've got a job for him on the points. All he's got to do, every half hour, push this little lever over and back, you see. That's all he had to do, to switch the, you know, like the points on a railway line, just to switch the tracks onto this line or that
line. Did you have a railway line over there?
Yeah, they were run on little railway lines.
And what were horses and carts?
No, these were tractor kind of things, you know, tractors on wheels, like little petrol driven tractors.
And they pull little line of trucks.
Little line of these trucks hold about 2 yards of sand in them, you see. And then they're tip trucks, you know, you take them from where the eye sand was to tip them into the low spot. Well, Ted's job was to do this. But Ted was even too bloody lazy to sit up and do that job. So he tied the string to his foot, so that when he kicked the thing over the lever to switch the points over, instead of having to go and pull it back like that, he'd pull it back with his foot, you see. Well, this is when McKinnon's coming along one morning, and him and Specs is having a gossip. Specs is not interested in working either. Neither of them was very interested in work. Good morning, Ted. Good morning, Specs. And they made it. They seen him coming. They said, we won't talk to him this morning. We bugger him, you know. So they wouldn't answer. Well, McKinnon gets up halfway past him and he thinks to himself, they're not bloody talking to me. He said, I said, good morning to you. He still didn't answer. He said, all right, if you don't bloody want to talk, don't talk, but take that bloody string off you for Anderson and sit up and do the points properly. Well, you know that Salmon Street going down to the bridge?
Yeah.
Their headquarters was there. Well, we'd say, oh, it's too bloody windy to work today. We'll get the sand in our eyes, you know. So, it was my job, I was the head boy, like the president of the branch of the CUC. Go up and tell him, Tom, it's too bloody dirty to work today and about letting us go home. So we wouldn't work, but we'd be sitting there for 2 hours, and And if he had a shirty old McKinnon on us, well, he wouldn't let us go home, you know. He'd say, oh, well, it's too windy, you better go home. It's not to be a sitting there. So I'd come, be trotting up the road, going to see McKinnon about letting the boys go home. It'd be a race day or something, and they want to put their trays on the race horses. And he'd see me come. And before I got anywhere near him, he'd be yelling out, no, no, no! And I'd say, what's the matter with you, Mac? What's this no, no, no business? I know what you want, I know what you want. You come to see about letting them get home. They can bloody sit and rock there. They won't work. That's the kind of bastard you turned out to be, Mac. I didn't think you was like that. And then we'd argue for a while and say, oh, bloody right, you may as well go home.
Was the Bend famous for bad weather? I mean, you got really bad weather.
Well, we made our bad weather too.
It was like a desert.
But and it was also cold, you get cold winds.
Yeah, but windy day, it would cut hell out of you in the eyes, but it didn't take much to stop us, because we said it being there, was either too cold, too hot, or too windy. Now, he had to get in between there. He had to get the... Well, they said, I don't know whether I told you this tale, all these kind of things that go on, we'd reckon that we never had proper drinking facilities, or proper drinking water, and there'd be a strike on. Another time the Sustenance Office never issued us with their issue of boots, you know, and we said, all right, we won't go down the bloody Bend to work until we get them. So that's another strike on the Bend. We was always on strike for something, wasn't we? So the Sustenance Officer said, all right, we'll issue the boots, providing you go to work. But they said, we're not going to issue them from the Sustenance Office in Bay Street. We'll issue them when you're on the job, see? So we said, all right, we'll accept that condition. So down we all marched to the job and went to the depot down there at Salmon Street. All get issued with our boots. We said, it's too windy, ta-da. And we go again.
How long did you work on the Bend? How many years?
Oh, how long do you reckon? 3-4 years?
You
going to
keep that going?
Yes, why not?
Well, it'd be hard to estimate, because there was a period when you're on the dole for a period without any work.
Yeah.
Then they introduced work for the dole.
That was after the strike?
Yeah. No, wait a minute.
Go on, you tell it.
Yeah.
Then there was work for the dole, because within all this given period, there was agitations, demonstrations, all the political priests were there with their batons to quieten them down. And in general, all this propaganda and agitation went on. Well, then they'd reach agreement. Right, well, now they'd go to work, and they'd work for their dole. But they wouldn't work for a ticket system. They had to be paid.
Cash.
Well, all right, then they reached the agreement. Right, $9 at 9 shillings a week for a man and wife they started out at.
Mm.
9 shillings for a man and wife. Mm. And 6 shillings for a child, I remember, I think.
Two and six.
I could have written down somewhere anyway.
Yeah. Then, of course, things started to develop. They were never happy.
Look, how many years would you say that...
Well, this is what I'm trying to, it's hard to estimate. From the time... Let me put it this way. Yeah. 1932, for us, things got very, very tough. Ticket system, and there was work on the Bend. Let's say around.
What year was we married in?
26, or that was before.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I never done much permanent work after that, did I?
No.
All casual work.
We're trying to estimate how many years you lived down there on the Bend.
Mm.
Before you lived in this house?
Oh, yes. He was having relief jobs then. We were living around in Albert Street, 32. I would say perhaps work for the dole, commencing with the ticket system, would have been somewhere around about 1934. And then it improved and improved and improved until we were getting 29 shillings a week. Mm.
And that when you were working on the Bend at that time?
Well, we were working on the Bend all the time.
Oh, I see.
Because that agitation was going on all the time for improvement.
Yeah. I see. So it was really, was the Bend finished by, say, the time the war came on?
Yes.
We were working right out, actually. The bin was finished in 39 when the war, because the troops were camped over there. They were camped. But actually, we never really got anything permanent back on the wharf until about 1939, until the wharf.
But then were you working on the bend on and off between in, back in the wharf? Were you? Did you work on the wharf for a bit and on the bend for a bit?
Yes, we used to do that. We used to, but I didn't. But most of them did.
I was
too involved in the class struggle. Yes. But most of them used to be chasing a quid on the wharf. Back on the wharf and at the same time drawing sustenance as well. That would include foremen on the waterfront too. It was only on a casual basis.
Now listen, what sort of work was it on the wharf, on the bend? All just pick and shovel?
No, just shovel, no pick.
And you're putting it on these little railway trucks? And
yeah, pulling it in and pulling the swamp area in. That fisherman's bend was not flat like it is now. It had... you know where we went down Williamstown Road and you seen those water holes?
Yeah.
That holes like that, there was quite deep holes down the bend. And it was recovering them by taking the mullock heaps or the sand mullocks.
There were sand hills.
Yeah, taking them from one place and putting them in another.
And was it covered with tea tree or...?
No, it was covered with tea tree originally. Mostly all tea tree and tussocks and things like that. There was rabbits and everything over there, you name it. Goats, rabbits. Cows and everything was over that bend. It was a complete open space. In fact, the first thing that originally bent on the Fisherman's Bend area was General Motors Oldham's. That was the first thing ever built there.
How many men would be working there at a time on the Sussert?
I'd say the unemployed figures in Port Melbourne at that time on sustenance, it'd be anything from 600 to 700, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And would they all be on the wharf, on the bend at a time?
No, they'd take their alternate turn.
See, to cut out your sustenance money, you'd probably have to work 2 days for the week, you see? Or 2 days a fortnight or something like that. You only cut out the amount of money, the equivalent of what you were getting. If you were getting 30 shillings a week, well, you cut that out in 2 days' work.
Oh, it wasn't like when you went to the country for 3 months at a time.
No, you only cut out your work.
It was award rates of pay.
And it was award rates of pay.
You went out to cut out that. Well, of course, we used to resent working for it as well. And this is the axe we used to put on all sorts of axe. So that this McKinnon, who was quite a reasonable fella, but he was trying to keep his job, the pressure was on him just the same. And this is the kind of things that we used to do to him.
Was he an older man?
Hmm?
Older man?
Oh, yes.
He'd be older than you?
Oh, yes. He's much older. He's dead now. Yeah.
And I think I remember you saying he was also a lay preacher in one of the churches.
No, that was one of the foremen. I was a lay preacher.
Did you get tough foremen?
Oh, yes. Some of them tried to be tough with us, but we used to tame them down here because we were such a close-knitted body in port that we could tame them. To give you an instance, they said to this McKinnon, the Public Works Department said to McKinnon, we're not satisfied with the work record down port. Down in Port Melbourne on the Fisherman's Bend project, and we don't think that you're being severe enough with them and not doing your job. Well, they said, we're going to replace you. We're going to put you over on the shrine on the boulevard, on the boulevard, and we're going to take the fella, I forget his name, from the boulevard, who was a real tough man, who was handling sustenance workers working for the Dole on the boulevard, the same as we were, but they were drawn from all different suburbs. South Melbourne, St Kilda, Paran, and all those sort of things used to do their work on the boulevard. It wasn't so closely knit at this point, and we're going to send him down there, and he'll get some production out of port, out of the sustenance workers in Port Melbourne. In other words, they said, we'll tame them, you know. So McKinnon sent for me and he said, I'm in trouble. I said, what are you in trouble for? We're the ones which all is in trouble. He said, well, I look like doing my job down here. I said, what for? Well, he said, they're going to send so-and-so, say Smith from the boulevard, down to take my place. And he said, he's going to get more production out of you fellas than what I got. So I said, he's not. In fact, he's going to get a worse production because McKinnon suited us because we could handle him. And we didn't want anybody we didn't want. So we said, you're not going to get the sack. Don't worry about that. So anyhow, to cut the long story short, they took McKinnon away and sent this fellow down. Well, for the month he was there, he got nothing. We wouldn't even work one day. So they pulled him off, and back McKinnon came, he's reinstated in his job again. So that was a question of the united front between these the dull workers and the supervisor. Well, then this, any bad foreman we had, as I told you before, we'd dig a hole in front of their hut and drop them in a hole, and they'd step in, and the next thing they're down the hut, and there'd be two or three waiting for shovels there, and they'd shovel the sand in and leave them there, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, what when you were talking before about like Anderson being lazy, was this, could you keep your job on the wharf if you were lazy? I mean,
well,
not dependent on your workmates.
Yeah,
no,
can't they lean on you?
I expect Ted would get the sack from quite a lot of jobs. He never had any respect of people on the waterfront. Ted is a cop. As a militant, I was going to say communist, but that's, as a militant, he never had any respect amongst the members because of this fact that he would not work.
Yeah.
You see,
how can you manage? Don't they? But doesn't the whole gang have to be pulling their weight?
No, I wipe off everything that's.
There's a certain amount of protection in it. There's a certain amount of protection. Because if that man, even though he's not doing his job, and that gets the sack, well, it leaves the gang short-handed, and if the gang's short-handed, they what they call get classed as unworkable, and all that gang sent out. Now, the Warpits would resent those kind of people just as much as we, as the boss would, you see, because of this factor, and because they wouldn't be pulling their weight. If you had six men down below, and only five was doing the work, well, that placed an extra burden on those five men.
Didn't the gang sort of discipline them, as it were?
Yes, well,
wouldn't you be find yourself, everyone be throwing things to him and that?
Ted never, fellas like Ted never belonged to a gang because no gang would have them. They were floaters, what they called floaters. No gang would have those people in it because of the fact. Now, Ted put most of his work and life in a very short period that he put in on the general waterfront. He worked at the Narana, mostly, the Tasmanian paper, which was a pretty easy going job, very little work attached to it. Him and Arthur Buno worked a hell of a lot of years at the Narana. And though Ted would get the sack off a job, that didn't matter. You see, he'd front up to another job the next day, a different job, different foreman, different company. Everybody would get to know him around the get to know these type of people around the waterfront. And there was plenty of them, and Ted wasn't an exception. There was plenty of those types of people.
What, were you in a situation where you could nip off and sleep, you know, behind the, in the cargo, or was it just that, you know, I mean, yourself from the job? How would you go about it?
No, well, good gangs, I'll tell you, if we struck people like that, we might be on a midnight ship to Long Midnight. And along a hammer bloke, a wharfie with a few drinks, and he'd be floating or something like that, and he'd go down the aisle and he'd start to take his boots off and looking for a corner in the wings to go to sleep. And we'd say, what are you doing, Jim? I'm going to have a snooze for a while. Where are you going to have it? Oh, I'll go into that corner there and have it for a couple of hours sleep. Well, I used to say to him, well, leave plenty of room for us because we're coming too. What do you mean? Oh, the other five of us, we're going to have a sleep too. But you can't do that, the bloody hook will stop. And then we'd be in trouble. That's right. If it's good enough for you, it's good enough for us, isn't it? Well, they call you all the bastards. They could lay their tongue there, but still they'd work. They'd have to work because, well, we used to get over it that way, you see. And as a delegate, I'd stand them on there, stand them to attention when they wouldn't do, you know, when there wasn't. For instance, if there's two men pulling the truck and one nicked off and left it to one, well, you just, the boss would say, oh, he wouldn't care as long as the hook was moving. And if the poor bugger was struggling with the truck and where two should have been pulling it and one was pulling it, and as long as the bloody truck got in there and their other mates had given me a hand to pull it in, covering for the bloke, but with the, you know, well, I wouldn't stand for that, you see. I'd just say, where's your mate? Oh, he's up to town or something. When he'd come back, I'd give him a nice old roast and threaten to side into the union for it. Well, you become unpopular with a small minority of people on the waterfront doing those things. Certain people wouldn't talk to you, even today there's certain people won't talk to me because of that, but I don't know, that's not important. I don't want them to talk to me, those type, any of them. But with the majority of waterside workers, and that you win their respect by doing those kind of things. They say, well, I expect that's repeatedly. I'm not being egotistical in saying this, that I was always a good delegate. You've heard Wharfie say that, haven't you? I was always a good delegate on the waterfront because I worked to a code. I give nothing to the boss and I ask for nothing. And that applied to my workmates as well. I never asked any concessions for them. If they run off the job and they got found out, if they came on drunk on the job and they got found out, I would not defend them. But if it was a union condition, that was a different proposition. And that's the way we work. Well, people like, because of the width and breadth of the industry, people could be lazy, could get away with quite a lot. If they didn't have a strong delegate, they could still get away with quite a lot if the delegate wasn't strong enough to stand up to them. And then you've got some elements of people that it wasn't very good to stand up to them, you know, and some would weaken on that account.
Yeah, somebody would be, they'd be big, yeah, and strong.
They'd try to stand over you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dutchie Young told me that about certain blokes. It was one bloke on the water, he said nobody was game.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Because he'd flatten you.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I think that, I just saying to Tom, I think that the violence seems to have been more entrenched on the Sydney waterfront than it did on the Melbourne. You know, foremen getting their toadies to belt you up and a lot of Miller's Point tough family.
It did happen. Like Jim Saunders, they set him up a couple of times. Mm. Guy Lawson was set up. I've been set up myself with these people. But you just had to stand up to them, that was all. You might get hiding sometimes, but you still stood up to them because... Mm. Once you let them get on top of you, you was gone.
Yeah, well, apparently, Dutchie was telling me about this case when some young militant bloke, it was after the war, an ex-serviceman, somebody picked him. This was in Healy's time. Someone picked him, and the stevedore and, you know, the manager of the company and all stood there and watched while this Miller's Point tough beat up this young bloke.
Mm.
And he said, well, I came down the next day and I stopped the job. And I said, there's not going to be no more violence. You know, it's taken us 20 years to get rid of the violence on this waterfront, and we're not working with that foreman. It was the foreman who picked
him. One of the foremen.
Yes, one of the picking, one of the Miller's Point families, you see. Mm. And he said, you know, we said that was one of the biggest things they had to fight on the Sydney waterfront was this violence, you know. Mm. So it doesn't seem to have been as strongly entrenched here.
No, it wasn't as strongly entrenched here because there was instances of it. For instance, that Terry Dean I told you about. I know one particular job of a fellow named O'Hara. He said to me, Tom, you better come home with me tonight. And he's getting an old man in, Terry, you know. I said, why? He said, I think O'Hara set me up for after the job. Well, you'd get instances like that, and so I just went home with Terry that day. Well, nothing happened, but that kind of thing did happen. The same Terry Dean, he wouldn't have been able to get near him as a young man, you know, like as far as physically he was concerned, Terry would have killed him. But because he'd had a reputation on the waterfront, because fellas like Terry Dean had a reputation on the waterfront and was getting old, and these young bucks, it always puts me in mind of the tale of the Aboriginal boy, what was the great boxer, I forget his name.
Dave Sands?
Lionel
Rose?
No, all much before his time. Anyhow, it's not important. But every mug around the pub was knocking him down when he got, you know, punchy. Just for the sake of saying they knock it down. Well, that same thing applied to the Terry Deans of the waterfront, and that, you know. Mm. As they got older, of course, these young bucks coming up, they thought they could stand out and and all that sort of thing.
Did you have this territorial sort of thing that they had in the Sydney waterfront? For instance, the men from the Loo never went to Garden Island.
No, well, no. You see, our waterfront was never spread out to that extent. You see, there's men never crossed the harbour to go to Balmain or any of those berths because they kept specifically to the rocks. The rocks was an area on their own.
Well, that was what Dutchie said. He never always worked on the rocks.
Rocks, yeah. Well, those that worked around the Loo and King's Cross area, they always worked for the Woolloma Loo, the Loo, what they call the Loo. Well, then there was the Surrey Hills mob and all that crowd. They'd work over the other side, over Balmain and all over the other side of the harbour. Well, ours wasn't spread like that. It was consisted of two areas, the river the dock and Port Melbourne. Now the only differentiation, which they never ever had in Sydney, was the stevedores, the Port Phillip stevedores, and the top enders, the warp labours. That never ever operated. But I'm wrong there. They did operate, because the Yongbury Mile was the interstate, the Sussex Street crowd was the interstate, the Loo, the Rocks, and was all deep water jobs too.
But what about Williamstown? Was that an area on its own?
There used to be a section of the Union over in Williamstown. They had their rooms there for years. As a matter of fact, we was unable to sell the property over in Williamstown for many years because the trustees had died and we had no one to sign it over and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was the crowd that followed the wheat boats and the flour boats, done nothing else but wheat and flour over at Williamstown. Very rarely come over this side of the river until later years, but in the early years.
And you sometimes used to go to Williamstown though, because Mr. Galbraith was saying he'd sometimes go over there.
Yeah, to build up Williamstown.
Yeah,
you see, some fellas did specialise in work. Some were timber workers, some were coal workers, some were following the bag cargoes, some had followed the wool cargoes, and just followed that. They specialised as much as they could in their own particular sphere of work.
You never specialised, did you? Because you came into a time when you couldn't damn well specialise.
No, anything and everything.
Work was work. Yeah.
See, Charlie Young, the secretary, never ever worked general cargo until the gang system came into operation in 42.
This is a point now. You're doing your book now on the Melbourne Branch waterfront.
Well, on the Melbourne.
Which in general, conditions and regulations and so on, which is a federal matter. Mm. But for the purpose of this Melbourne Branch book, you're going to have access to the records of the different mode of work that took place as the improvements right over the years, starting off the bull system.
Well, I don't know that I need the records. I really don't, because of the way I'm doing it. But what I thought, I thought I'd read up everything that there was written about it in this Harbour Trust book that Tom bought, And then, I thought that Tom could probably give me enough insight. And if there's anything we need to go to the records about, well, then we'd go. But I just was wondering if you need the records.
Well,
see, there's so many changes
as the records are concerned, the records were destroyed when Jerry Chappell was Secretary of the Union for 12 months. He sent them all down the bend to be bloody well
burned.
Why? I don't know. We don't know the reason to this day, but all the history of the Melbourne branch of the top enders was destroyed when Jerry Chappell was bloody Secretary of it. The same as what's the name in the Butchers Union destroyed all the records there. What was his name? He's a watchman later. Oh, he got into trouble with pioneers and that.
Oh, I remember him. He got the sack.
Yeah. Well, he destroyed all the Butchers records. Yeah. Well, ours were destroyed by Jerry Chappell either.
What union? Was that in the Union? That was the Union.
The Union. All the records of the Union.
It's not so much the records as all that change of mode of work, as your conditions improved, from the bull system and the pickup system, and
I've got a tremendous lot
from and the gang system.
Yeah, well, I've got an immense amount of
control. And the mechanisation of the industry, the introduction of the grabs.
Well, I thought
all
I'd...
of this work, and then as mechanisation grew, so work got less and less on the waterfront, more condensed in the hands of a few. See, these I think are very important to what the development of the Federation.
Well, what I'd thought about, what we haven't worked out, Tom, is what we thought of the last date we're going up to. We've got to make up our mind whether we're just going up to say the introduction of the gang system, or say the end of the war, or whether you was going to bring it to date. Because if you're going to bring it to date, it's going to be an immense book. I mean, you'd have to it's a different ball game, then, isn't it?
Right.
I thought perhaps we should say the end of the war. For this, because that's the end of an era.
That's the end of the era.
And it's an end
by
of
that
era.
Time, the gang system was well in operation.
Right.
Yes, so you could see the difference that the gang system made. And then I don't think we'll go up to containerisation. I think it'd be too complicated. I think we'll leave it to somebody else in 30 or 40 years' time when you can see. Well, it's in the middle. You can't see what's going to become of it.
There's a ringing of all those conditions through that period.
What effect of it?
That's what I think.
I mentioned with Watson the day. All these changes that take place on the waterfront. All these changes from long ships to short ships was opposed pretty strongly by the membership. There wasn't a general acceptance of them by the membership itself, because the first thing, their first reaction was, we won't earn enough money. Shorter ships mean shorter wages, smaller wages.
Mm-hmm.
The bulls were getting the work, the abs and ab nots. By the shorter ship meant that they spread the work out over, instead of being two ships, they spread it into three ships, which meant that more men got an opportunity to work. So the bulls opposed it to the detriment of the men that was not getting the abs and ab nots.